From KALW and PRX, I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point, stories of how women rise up. I think of Google and search engines in general as my second brain. It's there when I want to remember something trivial, like that actor's name in that movie or the title of that song stuck in my head. It's there when I'm doing research on a guest or when I'm talking with my production team about an author or a recent article I read. Need the answer to a question? Just Google it. And considering the fact that Google processes 40,000 search queries every second, which translates to 1.2 trillion searches per year worldwide, I Googled that stat, by the way. It's safe to say that nearly everyone with an internet connection or a mobile phone has adopted search engines as their backup brain. Empowering, right? But what if using this backup brain is backfiring on us? What if our reliance on search engines is perpetuating oppressive ideas and hateful ideologies, even swaying elections between those mundane pieces of information? My guest, Dr. Sophia Umoja Noble, was in library information school when she began to notice something that made her extremely uncomfortable.
Everybody was talking about Google like it was the new public library. So that was the first moment where I was like, wait, that's interesting.
Sophia had worked in marketing for 15 years before returning to grad school to study library science, and had always seen Google for what it really is, an advertising platform. And we, the searchers, we aren't their customers. Advertisers are.
So you have this combination of paying to optimize content, paying to make content visible, and then people clicking on that content, which signals it's credible or viable.
So what does this really mean?
Certain kinds of industries or ideologies can wholesale take over keywords and identities and communities.
That's right. The information you see in those search results are heavily manipulated through a strange, complicated digital dance, also known as an algorithm. One day, a colleague of Sophia's, Dr. Andre Brock, out of Georgia Tech, suggested she Google black girls. And when she did, she saw that the top search results were images that perpetuated negative stereotypes, misogyny, and exploitation.
And it wasn't just black girls, of course. It was Latina girls, Asian girls, who are also kind of victims of being pornified in Google search results.
I know the temptation is to Google it for yourself, but thankfully, since Sophia went public with this, Google has changed the results a bit. We think of the internet as the great equalizer, but the algorithms behind it, created by humans, is serving up content that is sexist and racist and biased. That discovery was the beginning of an investigation that eventually became Sophia's book, Algorithms of Oppression: How Search Engines Reinforce Racism. Dr. Sophia Noble joined me from a studio at the University of Southern California Annenberg School of Communication, where she's an assistant professor.
First, I did a very systematic study of a whole host of different identities. And I used the census categories as a way to kind of have a starting point for thinking about various kind of racial and ethnic categories. And then, you know, pairing those with boys, girls, men, and women. And so there were, you know, over 80 different combinations that I looked at. And people often ask me, of course, what happens when you search for white girls or white boys or white men? And I find that to be one of the interesting phenomena because, usually you'll get something like either White Chicks, the movie by the Wayans brothers, which was very popular on a search for white girls for a long time. But you might get other things like objects, you know, white girls' dresses, which meaning, you know, girls' dresses that are the color white. So white becomes that kind of a descriptor. It's not an ethnic or a cultural descriptor. It's more of like kind of a color associated with various kinds of objects. So that's, I think, interesting. And part of that is because, as we know, in the United States, most white Americans don't think of themselves as white. They just think of themselves as Americans or as their own kind of specific identity. So that's, you know, something that I try to think through, the complexities of that. But I was also interested in certain kinds of concepts. So, for example, if you did a search for a long time on the word beautiful, beautiful was synonymous in Google image search almost exclusively with images of white women. And again, you don't have to add the words women to the word beautiful, but conceptually, Google Images framed beautiful as kind of thin women who fit the kind of standard beauty, contemporary beauty standard. So I looked in the book at kind of specific identities, but then I looked at other kinds of concepts. And one of the things that I always have found interesting is that for many years, I've talked about that specific example of beautiful and how I thought that something like nature would be represented as the concept of beauty, at least first in Google image search. And over the years, I've noticed that Google has actually changed its algorithm. And now when you do a search on beautiful, you often get nature. So I find that, you know, an interesting kind of quiet, silent relationship between Google and I, or its programmers mm-hmm. and some of its critics, right? Or the criticisms that are levied, not just by me. Of course, you know, people like Jesse Daniels, Siva Vaidyanathan, who wrote a great book, The Googleization of Everything and Why We Should Worry. Jesse Daniels wrote a great book called Cyber Racism. I mean, they've talked about this phenomena, for example, for many years of doing a search on the word Jew and being led to Holocaust denial sites or anti-Semitic sites. And, you know, that's, I really trace even the kind of contemporary moments where that's happened, you know, on a variety of different searches that just get co-opted either by white supremacists or by large industries like the porn industry.
Yeah, well, I mean, the basic question in your book, I think, frames it up perfectly, which is to say, is it willful neglect or is it a profit imperative that is making money from racism and sexism? Like, who stands to benefit from having these images come up when the person searching is theoretically searching on what they think is just an amazing, well, as you said, new public library?
Right. I mean, one of the things I always try to stress to people is that Google search is not a kind of a public information portal akin to a library or a public library. It's really an advertising platform. And you can optimize a lot of content, you know, I mean, Google's main interest is optimizing content for its advertisers, for its clients, for people who pay it to make their content visible. That's the entire premise of Google search. And so that we don't understand how profitable racism and sexism are, is one of the reasons why I try to historicize some of these things and say, well, look, before we had the internet, racial stereotypes were really profitable in other places like Hollywood. Sexism has been really profitable. You know, sexually objectifying women is something that's been with us for a long time, and industries have made a lot of money off of that. And now those same practices are happening in an environment like the internet and in Google search, and not just Google. I mean, I could have really picked any big commercial search engine. It's just that Google is the monopoly leader and everyone else is trying to be like them. So it's important to study kind of who sets the tone for everyone else who's in the ecosystem.
For those who, you know, don't have a marketing background, who don't really understand how Google works, who just think the search bar pops up, I put in a request and ta-da, there's, you know, the results. Can you explain a little bit about how those search results do get pushed to the top and rankings and, you know, optimization and all these terms that marketers fling about, but the everyday person may have no clue about?
So there's a primary mechanism by which Google is looking to kind of do sense making of content for its clients. Now, a lot of people think that, you know, you and I, everyday people, that we're Google's customers, but we're not, because we don't really pay Google. I mean, that's how you become a customer. Large companies, big industries, and even everyday people who might use its advertising mechanism, which is called AdWords, engage in basically a 24/7 real-time auction to pay for certain words to be associated with their content. In essence, what they're saying is, I'll outbid the next person to make sure that when these keywords are used, they're connected to my content, right? So if you're in a large company, for example, let's say you're a big automotive company, well, you might have thousands of small little sites from all kinds of marketing campaigns that you've done, all kinds of events that you've done, as well as the commercials, all of the brand activity. And so you are, in essence, hyperlinking all of your sites back to a key domain. You have a big footprint, so to speak, and you're optimizing a lot of content. And this is why you often find very large companies and big industries who hit the first page of search results when you're looking for something. It's one of the reasons why even in the media industries, you're often going to find large corporate kind of multinational or national media organizations will show up on the first page because they have a lot of content and they are also trying to make sure that content is visible. So people are both looking at that content, and when they click on that content, that sends a signal kind of back into the ecosystem that this content might be legitimate or viable, it's popular. And those, you know, kind of come into play together. And then I guess I think of this kind of third element, which is people who have a lot of technical skill, who really know how to maximize, you know, things that we call metadata, right? Embedding keywords kind of deeply into the architecture of a website so that that helps those sites to become more visible too. And it's this confluence of the relationship between money and popularity and technical skill that I try to make more legible for people so that they do understand there are multiple processes happening. And it's not just a matter of what's popular is what we see, or what's most credible is what we see. Google says that they optimize for over kind of 200 different features or qualities that they're concerned with. And I guess the question for me is, how is it that certain types of decisions and values are in play, like we don't want child sexual exploitation to surface, but we'll let blackface come through, or we'll let pornography come through, right? Or we'll let racist or discriminatory kinds of disinformation come through, but we make sure that like animal mutilation doesn't come through. Those are the kinds of questions that I think help us elucidate, you know, the complexity of these environments, and more importantly, what values are at play.
Yeah, well, I mean, what is the argument for that? That, you know, we live in a society that allows free speech, and, you know, to do anything different would be censorship, because sexism and racism, although there are laws against it, are not explicitly illegal, like child sex exploitation is? I mean, what is the argument for not leaving those things out of the search results?
Well, this opens up a whole new area of conversation that I'm super interested in. So I'm glad that you asked this question. I mean, the first thing is, all of the large tech platforms on the internet are deeply invested in this idea that they are not publishers. They are not responsible for the content that moves through their platforms. They are simply kind of a technical architecture through which people are speaking, and they are not responsible for the things that people speak or do on their platforms. Now, this is really important. It's an important distinction for these companies because, one, they're very invested in a kind of libertarian notions of anything goes on the internet and there's no censorship. And two, if they become responsible for the kind of content that flows through their platforms, well, now we're in trouble because they really don't have the capacity to moderate all of the content that does come through. And I think here about people like Professor Sarah Roberts at UCLA, who's done, you know, groundbreaking research on the people who look at the most horrific content and screen it out before it makes it, say, to YouTube or Facebook or into search. So there are kind of massive armies of people who are precarious, low-paid workers for the most part, dispersed globally, who have to look at some of this horrific content, and they do screen it out. And, you know, you could use the word censor, you could say screen, you could say moderate. But what's important here to know is that decision-making is happening all the time in these platforms, and content is coming out all the time in these platforms. And so from the gate, they are not free speech zones. And I think that's something that we need to understand. And we also need to understand that the companies are invested in us thinking that they're free speech zones, because otherwise they have to take greater responsibility for the kind of content. For example, they've got to be responsible when disinformation campaigns move through their platforms that maybe undermine democracy or foment ethnic cleansing or genocide around the world. I mean, many of these companies are not in a position to deal with the volume of content that's moving through their platforms. And so they stay anchored to this idea that it's an anything goes and they're not responsible. That's really the public that's responsible.
As I was reading your book and thinking about the way that search results come up and the information that we get when we're looking to learn something, and like the term that just keeps coming to my mind is that it's sort of like it's the canary in the coal mine. Like it feels like it's just the beginning of what can go wrong if AI is allowed to be incorporated too much into our lives.
I agree. I think that, you know, this book was difficult to write because I think there are you know, many of us who are studying these different platforms and the consequences of them for vulnerable people, for democracy, you know, kind of for the future of education and information, which are really important elements of a democracy, having people who are educated. I think there are other kind of unforeseen consequences. Like, what does it mean that we have come to believe that there is an answer, it can be found in 0.03 seconds, and you know, a search engine can provide it. You know, we have universities, we have schools, people go through a long process from kindergarten through 12th grade, and if they're fortunate to go to college, they have those experiences, because becoming educated and learning is a nuanced, iterative process, and it's part of the human experience. And search engines giving us an answer in 0.03 seconds really truncates our thinking about what it is to know, what it is to learn, what it is to kind of make sense of our world. And those are some of the things that I noticed just more anecdotally as a professor with my own students who will write their papers from a search engine and not from the library, and who often use, you know, misinformation sites or kind of propaganda, like they can't tell the difference sometimes. And that kind of critical thinking and ability to discern kind of, you know, raw information, misinformation from knowledge. I use Google all the time because for kind of banal information, like what's that actor? I can't remember. Okay, great. But, you know, when you start getting really comfortable with the banal, you will take it to the more sophisticated, and people do ask more sophisticated questions of search engines. And, you know, in the book, I wrote a whole chapter about Dylann Roof, for example, trying to make sense of the Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman case. And we know that ultimately, in his own words, that, you know, he went to a whole host of these kind of white supremacist sites and maybe not knowing. We don't really know if it, but on some level, that information appealed to him. And ultimately, he opened fire on 9 African-Americans at a Black church in Charleston, South Carolina. So, it is important to think about, you know, not just the banal, but the more sophisticated and nuanced questions and the kinds of horrible information, quite frankly, that come back to answer those questions. I think over time, we're going to see that the stakes will be high for wanting those kinds of shortcuts and not taking the time to know better, to think differently, to appreciate science and philosophy, the arts, to just kind of lean on a crutch of a search engine for coming to understand our world. And that's really kind of the bigger project that I'm trying to communicate in this book.
Toxic ideologies are polluting our information sources at a rapid pace. And it's not reserved to places like Google or YouTube. Algorithms that power some of the most significant decision-making mechanisms in our society are, in essence, learning to bake bias into the system instead of eradicating it. More on this coming up. I'm Lauren Schiller. My guest is Dr. Sophia Noble. She's an assistant professor at Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Southern California. And her book is Algorithms of Oppression. I think it's worth talking about other ways that algorithms are impacting our lives. I mean, just back to this concept of, you know, search is just the tip of the spear in some ways. So, for example, here in California, a no money bail law was just passed. And instead, what they're going to do is have more reliance on running a risk assessment using an algorithm to determine whether the person who's been arrested should be released or held in the local jail while they await their court date. And they've already run tests on these things to show that it's totally racist. That you know, if you're and I don't know what the term is, moneyist. You know, if you're poor and you're a person of color, you're much more likely to be detained because for whatever whoever's designing this algorithm is biased.
Yes. Well, one of the things that's happening here in terms of all of these sentencing and risk assessment types of software that are being used in the judicial system. And the kind of criminal justice system is that for the most part, the data sets that are being used are based on kind of historical data collection that become the training data, so to speak, for these risk assessment kind of automated decision-making systems. And, you know, it's really important that when we think about artificial intelligence, I know that sounds like a really sexy idea, but it's just an automated decision-making system. And it's programmed and it's trained on data sets. Many times those data sets are deeply flawed. So you might not just have the bias of the engineers or the programmers, but it might be kind of their lack of understanding how those data sets are formed and the kind of historical and social politics and relationships that are embedded in them. I mean, what's interesting to me about these risk assessment projects is who they're pointed at also. I mean, you don't see these risk assessments pointed, for example, at Wall Street, who's most likely to defraud the country with, you know, betting against mortgages and causing a recession. You know, who at Dartmouth is going to go to Wall Street and defraud the country, right? You just like, no shade to Dartmouth. I'm just saying, like, you know, you have to look at who these tools are pointed toward, and of course, the biased data sets that go to inform them. And this is a part where I think, you know, this relationship between scholars who are studying this and the research that me and many others are trying to do, and linking that up with kind of a deeper critical tech literacy, algorithmic literacy, that, you know, we may be calling for one set of solutions to intervene upon vulnerable people, only to replace it with systems that are even harder to intervene upon. And one of the things that we are very worried about is the opacity of these algorithms and of the software, and how difficult it will be for a judge or anyone with low levels of data and scientific literacy to kind of even read the algorithm and understand its bias and, of course, its disproportionate and unfair impact on our society.
So where do you think, I'm trying to think about how everything that you're discovering and the public awareness of what is actually going on, how we as everyday people can use that awareness to, I don't know, I feel like we can't beat the machine, right? Like we can be the savviest searchers in the world, but we're, if we're still being served up information that is going to, without our even realizing it, change the way we think about certain things, how, what can individuals do with where we are right now?
Well, I think one of the first things that we can and should expect is that our information environments should not be deeply polluted. No more than we would expect, you know, the water and air to be polluted. I mean, we see, for example, places like Flint, Michigan, where, you know, the lack of regard and concern for vulnerable people has led to like a wholesale poisoning of thousands, tens of thousands of families, mostly African-American, for sure poor. So I think that, you know, in my line of work, I think, well, we have water regulation and air quality regulation. We have regulation over drugs and pharmaceuticals, over automotive industries, all kinds of technologies and systems and services and resources, natural resources that we're deeply reliant upon, that we need to have a high level of integrity. And I think that it's realistic for us to expect that if more and more public services and educational services and social services are moving, consumer experiences are moving to the web, that is an environment where we should expect a high level of integrity. And this is where, you know, many of us are saying we need a better regulatory framework. We certainly wouldn't let pharmaceutical companies develop drugs and just turn them loose on the public and say, let's just see what happens. And, those people died. We should take that drug off the market, you know, and like learn about it after people's lives have been taken or devastated. And yet we have a whole kind of tech sector that is literally developing projects and ideas either in labs or in garages or in all kinds of places and conference rooms and, you know, getting the venture capital backing and turning them out into the marketplace. And then we figure out after the fact, oh, that didn't work out so well. Maybe we should have rethought that. And I think we need some deep, much greater protections between some of these, you know, so-called great ideas and they're being kind of turned out to the public. Because one of the things that we know is that poor communities, communities of color, women, people who, children, people who are vulnerable in our society are really the data disposable. I mean, they're the people upon which these technologies are practiced and perfected, like the kind of no cash bail or predictive policing, right, or other kinds of services. And if you really want to get into the minutia of how some of that is devastatingly happening, you should read Virginia Eubanks' book, Automating Inequality, and it will really touch you, I think, and your listeners to kind of understand how foster care systems and medical services and the distribution of those to poor people are getting caught up in these kind of software-based systems, technical systems, and people's lives are really hanging in the balance.
Okay, and then there's just this little thing called the election of 2016. But before we even go there, you have something in your book that was about a study from 2013 about manipulating search rankings and how that could shift voter preferences without them even being aware.
Yes. So this is a really important study by Epstein and Robertson. They did a controlled study where they had voters do searches. And if on the first page, they were exposed to content that was negative about a candidate, they said they would not vote for them. And if it was positive about a candidate, they said they would vote for them. And they argued ultimately from the findings of their study that democracy was really at risk because search engine rankings are so easily manipulable that people don't even know if they are being manipulated. And I thought this was a really important study, and I talk about it a lot, and I try to share these scholars' work with others, because the truth is, there was an incredible amount of media manipulation happening during the 2016 presidential election. And, you know, we know this, and I think a lot of the focus has been on Facebook and to some degree Twitter, and the way in which misinformation or disinformation around Hillary Clinton, for example, circulated. But, you know, what people paid a lot less attention to were the ways, I think, that Google and its properties like YouTube were also being used. And one of the things that's particularly interesting to me is how people often use Google to fact check. So let's say they see something that doesn't make a lot of sense, or they're not sure. They're like, there was like a sinister conspiracy running out of a pizza shop, right? Let's go check that out. Well, they're most likely to go to Google to fact check that, right? Thinking that Google will be the place to do the sense making of things they find in social media. So I think that's a really important thing we need to keep in mind, again, about how the public relates to what they find. We know, for example, from the Pew Internet research studies, that people believe, more than 70% of the public believes that uses search engines believes that what they find there is accurate and trustworthy, right? That it's credible or reliable. And, you know, immediately following the 2016 election, the news was widely covering the story that if you did a search on final U.S. presidential election results, you were led, the very first site was a disinformation site that said that Donald Trump had won the popular vote. Now, you know, this isn't just an alternative fact. This is a flat out lie. And yet here we have half the country who to this day still believes that Donald Trump won the popular vote. And I think that these kinds of things, when we talk about the veracity of information, how can we trust information? How does information play a role in democracy and politics? Even just trying to make sense of the political environment is very, very difficult when people are deeply reliant upon a search engine and, by extension, social media.
So there's this sociologist that you talk about in the book, Herbert Schiller.
Yes.
And he was born in like 1919. I mean, he died probably 20 or so years ago, right? I mean, but he was around in the early part of the 20th century. And way back then, he coined this term packaged consciousness.
Yes. So Herbert Schiller is a really important media and communications scholar. Many of us study his work. And, you know, his life's work was really concerned with kind of the monopolistic corporate control over media environments and how less media would have a huge impact on democracy. So, you know, if you look at his work, he was kind of concerned with the way in which a small number of companies could kind of control the messages, so to speak. And this is, of course, really important because when you study other media scholars and you in media history, you know, for example, that more media and more voices is better for a democracy. And less media, fewer media companies, and I would include media tech companies now in that, is worse for democracy. And, you know, because a narrow band of messages and ideas can kind of permeate into the, you know, into the consciousness of the people. Certainly, you know, the abolition of the enslavement of African people, for example, was bolstered by the fact that we had at one time, you know, over 200,000 newsletters, pamphlets, and newspapers that circulated. And abolitionists were incredibly reliant upon being able to circulate a lot of stories and ideas about how, perilous and immoral the enslavement of other human beings is and was. And so, Herbert Schiller, to me, is really important because he's been an important voice for kind of speaking against monopolistic media control. And I reference him because I certainly think of Google as having kind of a monopoly on search and being a very important kind of primary first step and gateway into the information ecosystem online.
Well, you offer, I'm going to ask you to describe this visualization that you're offering up as an alternative way of viewing search results. Is that an impossible request?
No,
I thought it's
not.
Really cool, okay. And I think you should talk about it.
Okay. So, people often say, Safiya, everything you're talking about is a downer. And I admittedly, oppression is a downer.
As I cackle wildly. Anyway, yes.
I mean,
it is.
It's like we're laughing as a defense mechanism.
That's
I understand
right.
It. Okay. So, both of my parents were artists. And so the metaphors that I draw on, in my own life are often from the art world. And so one of the things that I said is, and I kind of argue for as a, it's really not fair to call this a solution because I don't really think it's a solutionist kind of approach to the complexities of the things we're talking about. Like there isn't just an answer. And if we did that or a different technical system, and then if we did that, it would be fine. But I do think that, like if we had a really diverse mediascape, so to speak, and we had multiple ways of thinking about finding information on the internet, that would be better than having one or two. So I use the metaphor of the color picker tool, which many of us know is kind of that color wheel where all the colors kind of blend into each other. And we're trying to, we use this often kind of, on the internet when we're looking for like a pretty color for our fonts or our objects. And, I use this metaphor to say, well, what if our interface to information on the internet was accessed through something that looked more like a color picker tool? Where if I put my search box on the red portion of the color picker tool of the color wheel, I kind of know that's the red light district, so to speak, of the web. And I know what's kind of coming there. And maybe if I drag it to blue, it's the government information or it's academic studies or it's research. And maybe if I drag my search box to the green part, I know that's going to be products or things for sale, right? Or kind of a more commercial environment. And maybe we could nuance this so that we could make sense of things that are kind of overlapping and meeting multiple interests. What I'm trying to do with the metaphor in the book is describe like, what would it mean if we had something other than a ranking system from 1 to 1 million or more as a way to make sense of the information we find online. And part of that's because we're in a cultural context, certainly in the US and in the West, where to be number one is to be the best. So if you go to a page and you're experiencing information in a rank order fashion, there's already a cultural context for number one being the best. We don't have a foamy finger at the football game that says 1,300,000, we're not doing that. We're doing number one. And so number one is something we might want to disrupt right out of the gate. The other thing I say that's really important to this is we need a non-commercial way of accessing information. And this is where I'm so grateful to librarians in particular who have been curating and sense-making and organizing knowledge for thousands and thousands of years for us. And we, whether it's oral forms of knowledge or print knowledge, they have done the work of kind of helping organize and not necessarily for a profit motive in the same way that an advertising platform like a commercial search engine is doing. And so I've been trying to raise money. And if there are any foundations or funders who are interested in supporting librarians, academic and public librarians in tackling, some of the indexing of the open web, I think that would be really viable and valuable to our democracy. We need just many, many ways of cutting in rather than having a handful of platforms kind of be serve as the gatekeepers. And to me, that is it's not that we need Google to go away. We just need, you know, maybe 1,000 more differently motivated search engines too.
Yeah, and that is, I mean, that's brilliant. And hopefully the antidote to what, you know, what I hear all the time, which is, well, I'm not going to try and, you know, when I talk with somebody who's in tech or involved with data, you know, I'm not going to try and recreate what Google's done. You know, they're already so far along. I'm just going to wrap my systems inside their systems. And so when I hear them say that and then I read your book and I talk to you, I'm thinking, no, so I'm going to give them your number.
I know. Call me. Hey, girl, call me. Listen, I mean, this is a challenge because, you know, I was just talking with my students this morning in class about Microsoft and remembering, you know, like people who would turn in their assignments in Apple's in Pages, and then, you know, the teachers couldn't open it. They're like, Pages, what is this? I can't even open this. If you just send it to me in a Microsoft Word doc, I can't. And now, you know, a PDF is finally broken through. I mean, there is something about the way that so much capital and investment is made by large institutions into only one system, whether it's software or, you know, interfaces, hardware, that it's very difficult to break in. I mean, ask all of the professors who want to work on a MacBook Pro and the IT folks refuse it because, you know, because it's too hard to support a PC environment and a Mac environment, right? So these kinds of decisions are part of what leads to kind of a shrinking of choices. And they happen at large kind of institutional levels, quite frankly. So I don't think that these choices really get to always be made by individuals. I think it's really about how public institutions and commercial institutions decide to kind of open up new possibilities. And of course, we need many, many more non-commercial public interest types of technologies.
I want to ask you about, we haven't, you know, this is a show about how women rise up. We haven't really focused on how this applies to that. But you do have, you do write in your book about taking a Black feminist technology studies approach. And I wanted to ask you to talk more about what that means.
Well, you know, in the book, I do say that we need kind of a Black feminist technology studies approach to thinking about, you know, not just Google, but a whole host of platforms and technologies. And, you know, what I mean by that is that Black feminists, activists, scholars, community organizers, mothers, aunts, people have really been about centering those who are the most vulnerable. Now, in many cases, those are also other African-Americans or Black people, but this idea of thinking about how do we center people who are the most vulnerable in our society? Because, you know, when they rise, everyone rises. When, you know, you eradicate poverty, when you eradicate, you know, discrimination and systems that hold these kinds of, you know, second and third class types of citizenship or belonging in place, which often Black women have, you know, borne the brunt of both racist and sexist systems simultaneously, and have also been on the forefront of organizing for civil rights, for human rights, for women's rights. And so I basically am saying, I mean, it's those traditions and from those, you know, quarters that some of the most innovative and important and just and humane and fair ideas have come to existence in our society. And I do believe that. And I think history, you know, bears that out. So what would it mean if we centered these ideas about the most vulnerable, the most precarious, and we designed our technologies with those things in mind? Well, what it would mean, for example, would be that when we're making hardware, like all the electronics that we use, especially those that are reliant upon any kind of microprocessor chip, that we would be mindful and we would not engage in exploitive, extractive mining relationships. So we would design microprocessor chips that didn't foment, the abuse of people who do that kind of labor and their exploitation. We also would design technologies that, for example, when we're done with them and electronics, when we're done with them, don't get loaded up on a barge and shipped to China or shipped to West Africa to poison their environment. Through kind of being dumped into huge new toxic e-waste cities, we would design differently if those things were in our front yard here. I mean, if you had to dump all of that in Palo Alto, trust me, there would be a totally different set of design imperatives. They'd be biodegradable. You might even be able to eat your phone when you're done with it. I don't know. I'm just saying it would be completely different. It'd be organic. You know, so this is what I mean about a different set of values that could help us rethink and reimagine. And quite frankly, we really must do this because the tech industries, all of these electronics, the mining, the use, the storage of all of the data, that's supposedly in the cloud, but is actually in huge server farms. The environmental degradation that is happening from the ways that we live as human beings now is, it's indescribable. It's another day for, talking about terrible things, but global warming and all of these kind of environmental disasters, the tech industries are implicated in that. And so this is why I say, what if we designed with a different set of values? And I think that Black feminists have given us some amazing values, and we've seen a lot of remedy from human suffering and a denial of rights and participation in society that Black feminists have really helped us reimagine in this world. So I think that's a great place to go for new thinking we just need a Black feminist Silicon Valley, and I'm here for that. And I think that we'd have a lot of fresh new ideas and a lot of really different kinds of ideas come to the fore with it.
We're living in a moment where the keys to our portals of knowledge are in the hands of the rich and powerful, the people who have the least to gain and the most to lose from changing the system we live in today. So the rich and powerful design systems that profit from clickbait over credible information. And when attention-grabbing disinformation is spread, then you have the seeds of division. Dr. Sophia Noble has a vision of righting this profit-driven order of things. She sees a world where we design systems around the most vulnerable, so we all rise, instead of serving only the most powerful. Dr. Sophia Noble is the author of Algorithms of Oppression: How Search Engines Reinforce Racism. We'll put a link to it in the show notes at inflectionpointradio.org. The sooner we understand how to find and share reliable sources of information, the sooner we can end the algorithms of oppression. This is how we rise up. This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. That's our Inflection Point for today. All of our episodes are on Apple Podcasts, Radio Public, Stitcher, and NPR One. Give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the podcast. Know a woman with a great rising up story? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, I invite you to support Inflection Point with a monthly or one-time contribution. Your support keeps women's stories front and center. Just go to inflectionpointradio.org. We're on Facebook at Inflection Point Radio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter at LA Schiller. To find out more about the guests you heard today and to sign up for our email newsletter, you know where to go, inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced in partnership with KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and PRX. Our story editor and content manager is Alora Weaver. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.